Madame Leota, the medium who was chanting the plaintive incantations, was quite unique. She was truly a disembodied spirit, a mere talking head inside a misty crystal ball. As she invoked the spirits, objects floated about the room in response to her supplications.
Serpents and spiders, tail of a rat, call in the spirits wherever they're at. Rap on a table. It's time to respond. Send us a message from somewhere beyond. Goblins and ghoulies from last Halloween, awaken the spirits with your tambourine. Creepies and crawlies, toads in a pond. Let there be music from regions beyond. Wizards and witches, wherever you dwell, give us a hint by ringing a bell.
Mike, something's moving there in the corner.
It looks like smoke. There's another one.
WMFO Bedford.
We must leave this cozy little circle. For the spirits have received your sympathetic vibrations and are beginning to materialize.
The ghost host led Mike and Karen through another doorway and onto a balcony overlooking a grand hall. Party was taking place, one of the strangest parties you've ever seen. There was a long dining table covered with decayed food and withered flowers. Cobwebs were everywhere. It seemed to be a birthday party. And when the birthday ghost blew out the candles on a cake, several other ghosts disappeared. They reappeared when the ghost inhaled again. And there was an elderly lady rocking and knitting. And when she rocked forward, she disappeared. When she rocked back, she too reappeared. Several ghosts were playing on the chandelier over the massive dining table. Others were waltzing while an organist played a haunting refrain.
This is crazy! I don't believe what I see! Why did we ever come in this house?
There's a door at the end of the balcony. Come on.
Mike and Karen entered the door and came face to face with a ghost dressed as a bride. She was strangely illuminated, and her heart glowed red with each heartbeat. The room they were in was an unfinished attic. And as they turned to run out of the door, another ghostly manifestation appeared and blocked their way. He was a cloaked figure with an evil, grinning face. A hatbox hung from his hand. With each beat of his bride's heart, his head disappeared from his body and appeared in the hatbox.
We're trapped! There's no way out!
Hold the candles. I'll try to open this window. Come on, we're in luck. There's a balcony out here. Watch your step. The rain's made everything slippery.
The candles went out again.
Just leave them. We're outside now. Everything's gonna be okay. There's some steps down at the far end.
But they lead to the graveyard.
Come on, it's the only way.
Our adventurous pair descended the steps to the ground level and began their walk through the private burial grounds, trying to find their way out of this living nightmare. They passed an old caretaker holding a lantern, too frightened to speak. His dog was cowering at his feet.
And begin to vocalize. Grim, grinning ghosts, come out to socialize.
Now don't close your eyes and don't try to hide.
Or a silly spook may sit by your side.
Shrouded in a cat disguise.
They pretend to terrorize. Grim, grinning ghosts, come out to socialize.
Climbs high on the dead oak tree.
Looks so ripe for the midnight spree.
Creepy creeps with eerie eyes.
Start to shriek
and harmonize. Grim, grinning ghosts come out to socialize.
When you hear the knell of a requiem bell,
weird ghosts came where spirits dwell.
Restless bones etherealize.
Rise as spooks of every size.
There was music all around them, and the sky was filled with whiskey spirits. They passed a group of minstrels who paid no attention to their presence. One was playing a bagpipe, another a harp, and another a horn. And there was a hunchback playing a flute, and a cadaverous drummer pounding out the temple on a gravestone. A group of cats and a family of owls joined in with spooky harmony. There was a king and a queen balancing a teeter-totter on a gravestone, and a duchess sipping a cup of tea. And they saw a hearse stuck in the mud. The coffin had slipped out, and its contents, a shrouded corpse, also was sipping a cup of tea. Behind the hearse on a hill, a group of ghosts were enjoying a bicycle ride through the tombstones. A huge masked executioner was singing a duet with a decapitated knight who held his singing head in his extended hand.
There's that raven again.
Are you sure we're going the right way?
I think so. There's only one path. It looks like there's something up ahead.
Oh, that's a crypt. That's the one by the fence. It's the way out.
Come on. Stay close.
Did you enjoy your visit? I told you you would not be harmed. Thank you for spending some time with us. Come back again. Bring your friends, if they'll believe the story you tell. I have a girl now. It's midnight. Pleasant dreams.
Thank you.
about to enter a new dimension of experience. You will venture to a place beyond imagination, where both space and time deform into grotesque realities.
Here is the actual sound of a person who's just finished dining at Kingston Seaway Restaurant.
Hello. Hello, baby. Hello.
Wow. You're some operator.
I was born in a basement in 1959.
Editor's note. No filter or increase in tape speed were used for these scenes.
Without you as the liaison between McDonald's Corporation and the customer, we're dead.
A free candy bar for every child that knows what grows in the secret garden. The answer, of course, is love, hope, and happiness.
Thank you for letting us introduce you to one of the finest entertainment products available, and happy motoring.
WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture, ask, sort of, a different dimension of The Big Picture tonight. Think of this as an extended edition of What's Hot. As for the next couple of hours, roughly, I'm going to take you into the world of giallo.
Nice.
My very favorite film genre. Chris Earle is going to be joining me for part of the show tonight. Nice to have
Thanks
you with us. Chris, of course, is the host of my favorite WMFO show.
Thank you.
That isn't On the Town with Mikey D. And that would be Watch This, which I've covered for you a couple of times. And felt the need to get spooky with Shea Spillane out tonight.
Yeah.
And if I'd known you weren't going to be around next week, I would have done this show next week.
Oh, you're going to be here for Halloween?
I am, but Shay and I are going to be playing some scary songs and, you know, talking about fake horror instead of the real horror.
Avoiding the kids, avoiding the children.
Yeah, I'm leaving the wife at home to answer the door.
That's good. That's cool.
Somebody has to do it.
I did it once when we had a Wednesday, so it had to be, what was it, at least 7 years ago, right? 6 or 7 years ago. I had the radio show here on Wednesday night and Halloween fell on it. So I decided, let's put some candy outside. And I put take two. And you know what happened, of course, when I got home? The entire thing was gone.
Oh, yeah. Like one kid came by and was like, yeah. Jackpot!
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the rest of the house had been toilet papered.
So this year, nothing.
Yeah. See, we're actively, very, very actively, you know, launching preemptive attacks against the kids in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like, yeah, you want to sit in the driveway? No problem.
Mm-hmm.
Halloween, full-size bars. That's right. Kids, come on down, get some full-size bars over at the Gary House.
Yep, that's what I did the first year I moved in.
In Wakefield. Because you're basically buying insurance against teenage vandalism and hijinks when you get older. And the house next door to me has got a bunch of kids in it. And, you know, they're still, like, they're varying ages, like high school down to late elementary school.
Oh, yeah. So you can have a family of problems there.
I potentially have a decade worth of torment ahead of me if I don't keep these kids happy.
Yeah.
Things you learn.
What was the name of those two Western families? The McCoys and
the Hatfields and the McCoys.
Hatfields. Yeah. Careful with that. You have a family warfare for 20 years.
That was I think that was in Tennessee, Kentucky, somewhere was going on. So tonight, with a little bit of help from Chris Earle and trailers and other assorted sound clips, we're going to talk about giallo movies. Now, Chris Earle is a well-known fan of horror movies.
I am.
You love them. What if I told you that the most influential horror movies of all time were made by the Italians?
I'd say I agree. But yeah, you got to give us a little... a little taste of what giallo is. What
Absolutely.
Is giallo?
Well, this is to talk about giallo and what it is. You've got to go back to the very beginning. And in the 1960s, which is the period when giallo first comes to the forefront, horror is really kind of spinning its wheels. The dominant horror films of the day are being made by Roger Corman and the Americans and by Hammer over in the United Kingdom.
Right.
And they're basically either riffs on the Universal monsters, or they are, in the case of Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe adaptations. So pretty much, if you're going to see a horror movie, it's going to be set in a haunted castle or a haunted house.
Sure.
There is going to be a vampire or some sort of mad aristocrat running around.
Right.
And there are going to be women wearing a period dress that is, at a minimum, revealing and, under the best possible circumstances, entirely transparent.
Sure.
So this is where horror lives in the around 1960.
Where frightened people are held in the grip of unearthly horror. Beware of pity for the handsome prisoner in the Castle Meister. Beware of love, for in your heart is only the pulsating throb of terror. Starring Peter Cushing as the Doctor locked in mortal combat with overwhelming evil. Also starring Freda Jackson as Greta, who served the vampires with insane loyalty.
You needn't be afraid, she's dead.
Martita Hunt, the Baroness, victim of her own son. Beautifully Von Morlor, France's latest sex kitten, as Marianne, whose beauty was her passport to the twilight world of the undead. David Peele as the Baron, blindingly handsome. Yet his kiss transformed the most beautiful girls into monsters.
This has been going on for about 10 years at this point.
Yeah.
And audiences are still showing up because, you know, they have France's latest sex kitten.
Sure.
Starring in a role and running around in a boudoir. But the audience is dying down. And the reason the audience is dying down is because they've seen every possible permutation of these films.
Right. You have The Brides of Dracula, The Frankenstein. You got a whole bunch of different... It's pretty much all the Universal stuff, especially Hammer stuff. There's a lot of great Hammer movies, but they're using the titles over and over again, and the characters over and over again, and then the same people over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee.
Within that lexicon, there are excellent films.
Yeah.
But when it gets to be the only thing that's playing in the horror space over and over and over again,
yeah,
the audience starts to drift away. So 1960.
Mm-hmm.
Audiences are looking for something new. Audiences are looking for something meaty and different.
Sure.
And an English director comes over to the United States of America and gives them exactly what they want. Alfred Hitchcock will make sure that you never want to go into a shower in a motel room ever again. Psycho becomes one of the biggest international hits of 1960.
It's a great movie.
And there are reasons why it becomes such a hit. That sequence is one of the greatest scenes in all of cinema.
Sure.
But the thing that really gets people excited about Psycho is that the film is modern. Mm-hmm. The film is set in contemporary America. And it's set in one of those little out-of-the-way, hard-to-find places off the side of the main highway.
Right.
Way down a country road where, you know, in the American horror tradition, building on the old folk horror tradition, scary things lie. Mm-hmm. You don't go to that little motel out in the middle of nowhere because you don't know who's around there. And they're probably not like us.
Right.
He breaks a bunch of rules in this film. All right. Janet Leigh is very famously in the shower, completely naked. But you never actually see any nudity mm-hmm. in this scene. You never actually see any blood in this scene. But it is heavily suggested.
Yeah.
He uses sound effects in that sequence in a terrifying new way. And he kills who is supposed to be the main character of his film.
Right.
30 minutes into it.
Yeah.
So now you're like, well, wait a minute. If he's going to do that, what could possibly happen next? Mm-hmm. And this is completely opposed to everything that we've seen from the very, very well-trod Edgar Allan Poe tales, which everybody knows, and the vampire and the werewolf and the Frankenstein and all the rest of this. Everyone knows the formula. One of the biggest things that Hitchcock does here is he breaks the formula. Mm-hmm. So audiences are now like, we want more of that.
Sure.
And in particular, European audiences are like, we want more of that. And the first person to take a shot at giving them more of that is an established Italian director by the name of Mario Bava. Now, Bava has done tons of costume pieces. He's done tons of historical drama. He's done comedy. He's done pretty much everything in the Italian cinema. And he's actually far enough into his career that he's thinking of giving up. He's like, I just want to retire. I've really kind of done everything that I want to do. Mm-hmm. He is approached by a couple of very, very important people. Samuel Arkoff and Jim Nicholson. And if you don't know those particular names, you know the name of the company that they ran. American International Pictures, which, if you are a horror fan, is the name in early 1970s into late 1970s horror cinema.
Yep.
Some of the biggest grindhouse hits and some of the most exploitative films were released by American International. Now, early on, Arkoff and Nicholson basically just wanted to take Italian films, which were playing well throughout Europe, and make them with an American audience in mind. So they approach Mario Bava and they say, we want to do one of these. And we want to do something that's like Psycho. We want to do something that's like Hitchcock. And Bava comes back with something that is very much like Hitchcock. A film that nearly shares a title with a Hitchcock film. Even though it was released in the United States as The Evil Eye and presented as a sort of a supernatural, it's not at all. It is the first ever giallo, heavily influenced by Hitchcock and known as the girl who knew too much.
Supernatural powers of the evil eye claim still another victim. Its malevolent enjoyment of tantalizing torture hangs threateningly over John Saxon, Letitia Roman, and Valentina Cortese.
Oh, she was always against me. She hated me.
Madness and the maddening aura that destroys reason fills their every breath with the smell of death.
Miss Drosson, have you ever seen the murder before?
No, I've never seen anything like that. Never.
Oh, stop playing games, will you, Landini?
I don't know what you're trying to do, but I know that you're involved in this. Perhaps Nora has seen the killer. But how do we know that he hasn't seen her?
The evil eye, like relentless tides, reaches out for them. And they defiantly hold ecstasy and horror in their arms and touch lips with terror, while the evil eye watches their every kiss and invades their subconscious.
Now, this film does a couple of things. First of all, it nearly ruins Mario Bava. It is not a success at all. It is his lowest grossing film ever in Italy. It does not make back its production costs. It also establishes John Saxon, who you may remember from A Nightmare on Elm Street, who pops up rather frequently in a lot of these international genre pictures, mainly because he did this. This is a film that really sort of put him on the map. And what they wanted to do was they wanted to make an American film under the Italian studio system. So they put American actors into it. Everybody's speaking English. And in putting this story together, Mario Bava basically lays out the blueprint of what the giallo will become. There are five elements that make a giallo. The first one is someone has to witness a murder. And the more vulnerable and out of place that person is, the better. In this case, it's a young woman who has traveled over to Italy because her grandmother, or her aunt rather, is in the hospital. And her aunt dies. And she's upset about that. And as she is leaving, she witnesses a murder and then passes out. The second element that you need for a giallo is police. The person who witnesses the murder winds up having to investigate it on their own. And there are two standard reasons why this happens. Number one, the police don't believe them, which is the case in The Evil Eye or
The Girl Who Knew Too Much.
Yep. The police think she's just hallucinated the whole thing. So they're not taking her seriously. Even though she knows what she's seen, she's afraid that the killer has seen her and the killer is possibly coming to get her.
Right.
Now, the audience knows all of this, and we know the police are idiots, but the police aren't going to be there to help. Now, the other reason why you might not want to go to the police is because you are engaged in something, either deviant sexual behavior or excessive drug use, or maybe you accidentally murdered somebody, that would keep you from going to the police. So when the police show up and try and help, you're like, oh, no, 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 I'm fine. I have no idea what's going on.
Right.
So you witness a murder. The police aren't going to help. Those are the first two elements. The third element, and probably the signature element of the giallo, is a black-gloved killer who is racking up the body count and slowly but surely getting closer to our original witness, the person that we are supposed to root for. The weapons of choice tend to be open razors and knives, but an industrious and resourceful giallo killer will use whatever happens to be handy. It could be chainsaws, it could be fireplaces, it could be fine art. The main thing is they're dressed all in black, wearing black leather gloves, a hat, and something covering the face so that you have no idea who this killer is. The fourth thing that you need is the killer has to be revealed and stopped in the final act of the film. These films are based on Italian potboilers. Starting in the 1920s, Mondadini, which was a publishing company in Italy, started producing Italian translations of mystery novels and American noirs.
Right.
So they published the Agatha Christies and they published the Sam Spades and all that sort of stuff. Mussolini comes along and he says, no more importing this Western filth. this deviant Western rubbish. So the Italians start writing their own versions of these. Mm-hmm. All of these books had yellow covers, usually with some sort of very lurid illustration on the front.
Right.
And they were known as I Libri Giallo. That was the name of the series that Mondadini published. Those novels sort of became the inspiration for what Bava and later Argento and Fulci are going to do in their movies. So the Italians started referring to the movies as Giallo and Gialli, which is the plural, because of their close connections to this literary history of detective stories and sleaze. But the interesting thing is, the Giallo don't ever quite cross. Some of them arguably do. The Giallo don't ever quite cross over into just pure sleaze territory. There's always a reason why these things are happening. These are always in service to the film. So the final thing that you need is innovative and striking cinematography. And the original, The Girl Who Knew Too Much, is probably the one area where it's lacking. It's a black and white film. It was made on the cheap. It uses a lot of the Hammer style of lighting, heavily based on the German Expressionists. So it's not the most visually compelling giallo that's out there. But it does have a few moments, and it has every other element that's necessary. For bonus points, you get a lot of female nudity. A lot of female nudity. Shocking, grisly, gory, bloody murders, psychosexual themes, and a title that contains a color, a number, or the name of an animal, such as The Red Queen Kills Seven Times or The Cat on Nine Tails. Mm-hmm. So if you see those titles and it's made by an Italian and it's from the period between roughly 1964 and 1975, pretty good bet that you're watching a giallo.
Sure.
And if you're watching one of the better known ones, pretty good bet that you are watching a movie that had a massive, massive influence on everything that happened in cinema since. Girl Who Knew Too Much doesn't do well. Bava is undeterred. Because a year later, they give Mario Bava total creative control and basically say, go ahead and make a movie that you want to make. He'd had a couple of big successes, and they were just looking to get something else out of him. He responds with the film that is probably the first complete giallo, and still an absolutely mesmerizing film to this day, Blood and Black Lace. Blood and Black Lace gives us the first ever total on-screen appearance of the faceless killer dressed entirely in black. And in this particular case, it is someone who is looking for a piece of evidence that will connect someone to a murder that has taken place in an Italian high fashion house. Mm-hmm. This film is still grappling with the Hammer legacy, and it's still grappling with the Gothic horror tradition. But what Bava does is he infuses that with a sort of with a bit of the psychedelia that is starting to infuse culture. And this is one of the early examples of like really, really modern looking titles and interesting dissolves and a sort of dreamy quality to everything. The colors are super saturated. At various points in the film, Bava has people in full body suits playing mannequins.
Right.
And it's stunning because you know they're real people, but they never move, they never do anything. And it's just this little bit of stylistic excess that he puts into it. We're still dealing with Dark and Stormy Nights. We're still dealing with a lot of those sort of Gothic and Baroque horror hallmarks. But Bava is also doing something entirely new here. There's one sequence in this film early on where a fashion show is taking place. And the camera is outside the back wall of the prep room. Well, the back wall has been removed. So we recognize that there should be a wall there, but there's not. And the camera is tracking back and forth across the room as we follow the action from each individual dressing room to the next dressing room. And this is the kind of stylistic, unexpected movement that is going to become a major, major part of giallo film. One of the things that people love about it is how inventive the Italians were in their camera moves, in their lighting, in the things that they were willing to put on screen. No one has ever accused an Italian of being subtle. The Italian aesthetic is richness almost to the point of vulgarity. Mm-hmm. And as in everything else, the giallo films become a question about how far can we push things? How much can we get away with? So you've got all of this grisly, horrible murder taking place on screen, set in some of the most beautiful and lush locations imaginable. Proved to be a very, very heady mix, proved to be very, very popular among audiences. But it wasn't quite what giallo would become. It will take one more director, a young man with a unique eye and a tremendous vision to create the full giallo as we came to know it. And now we're going to take a quick break here on WMFO Medford. And when we come back, the modern era of horror cinema truly begins. This is WMFO Medford.
You're not wired to have a response to this sound. You're neutral to it. You hear it every time you finish a meal and never feel anything. But if we were able to associate this sound with a new stimulus, save the food, we've achieved pulling a natural response from you. Save the food. Why are we doing this, you may ask? Save the food. Because this ad is trying to change your after-meal behavior through brainwashing. Because food waste costs the average family $1,500 a year. Save the food. Cha-ching. And $1,500 extra bucks is like getting a pay raise. Save the food. Cha-ching.
You're promoted.
Which could pay for your child's braces. Save the food. Cha-ching.
You're promoted.
Check out my braces.
So when you hear this sound, rethink your behavior. Cook it, store it, share it. Just don't waste it. For tips and recipes, visit SaveTheFood.com. Brought to you by NRDC and the Ad Council.
I'm going to the hardware store.
Oh, will you pick up 800 lumen bulbs?
800 more flowers? The neighbors will think we're wacky.
Not flower bulbs, light bulbs.
Come on, Dad. Lumens tell you how bright the bulb is. We can replace our 60-watt bulbs with energy-saving bulbs that give off about 800 lumens.
So we'll save money.
Right.
Got it. 800 lumens and more savings.
Lumens, the new way to shop for light. Learn more at energysavers.gov.
Thank you.
WMFO Medford, this is The Big Picture, a special Giallo appreciation edition of The Big Picture as we get geared up for Halloween. Chris Earle.
Hello.
Of Watch This is with me. We've talked about it, you're a horror guy.
I am a horror guy.
You love horror movies as much as I do. Mm-hmm. How's your Italian horror resume? Have you seen a lot of the Italian stuff?
Yeah, I've seen most of the ones that you're talking about. And I enjoy them. I'm not completely in love with them, but I do like them. But you're right when it comes down to, like, when you start talking about Dario Argento. He's pretty amazing in all the stuff that he does.
They are a bit of an acquired taste, yeah. Because, to be fair, as films made for an international audience, they weren't paying much attention to what the actors were saying.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in a lot of Argento's films, you had actors saying their lines in three or four different languages.
Yeah.
Because they knew everything was just going to be dubbed after the fact.
There's a lot of charm to that, though. It's got a lot of charm.
Yeah. And it does sort of add to the uneasiness of watching those movies, because yeah. It's like something there is off.
Sometimes some of this stuff is so over-the-top gory, it's just like, what? It's just, but I mean, it also makes a great horror movie. You know? It depends on what you're in the mood for a horror movie.
Well, there's a big, I mean, these films obviously went on to influence the American slasher genre.
Sure, yeah.
You know, Friday the 13th is a direct homage to a Mario Bava film, and we'll talk about that movie a little bit later tonight. John Carpenter's Halloween, very heavily influenced by the Italians. Eli Roth, who you know, very heavily influenced by the Italians.
Cabin Fever and Hostel,
And the thing about the Italians is, you know, as I said before the break, it was all about how far can we push this. Yes, these are gory movies.
Yeah.
But it's not gore for gore's sake. These things that happen in these movies serve the story.
Yeah.
And the Italians are not shying away from the brutality. And they're not shying away from the sexual nature of this.
But, yeah, what's interesting is there's a lot of beauty in them. I mean, just like you said, the use of color, or just you have some of these, you know, you got some really good-looking people in it, actors and actresses, or you have just a really beautiful background or setting, you know, where it's just a lot of places are just gorgeous, you know, a lot of the scenery and stuff.
We're going to take this gorgeous Italian modern house, mm-hmm. and we're going to spray it with blood.
Right.
Is really what it comes down to.
Yes, and it's going to be the reddest blood you've ever seen.
Yeah. A lot of these films have elements that take place in the fashion world.
Yeah.
Really, a lot of them. Because it was an opportunity. Italy was the height of style, design, and fashion in the 1970s.
Yeah.
All over the world. Everybody wanted Italian stuff. And they deliberately set these movies in that world so that they could show everything off. And parts of these movies are shot like travelogues.
Yeah.
And the rest of them are shot like nothing you've ever seen before in your life.
Right, right.
And this brings me to one of the critical films in Giallo, and a film that really anybody who has an interest in modern filmmaking, modern cinematography, horror movies, needs to see. And not as well known as it probably should be. Outside of Italy and outside of Europe. The setting is Rome. The year is 1970. A young American student is walking home alone when he notices something happening in a nearby art gallery. He rushes over to investigate what's happening and finds himself trapped between two glass doors, helpless to stop what's happening on the other side, or even to free himself.
Thank you. coraggio, apra! Non posso entrare! Su, cerchi di farsi forza! Coraggio, avanti! Chiami la polizia!
La polizia!
Aiutami! Aiutami!
The mounting horror of that scene as he is watching what he believes to be a girl dying,
yeah,
is matched only by the inventiveness of Argento's cinematography.
Yeah, it's great.
Which basically puts our hero in a glass box, mm-hmm. completely unable to do anything, that fills the entire screen.
Yeah.
This film is a revelation.
Yeah, it's great.
And it sends shockwaves throughout cinema, because Argento is an interesting figure. As a 30-year-old director, he has memories of World War II, but he is completely divorced from all of the politics and all of the thoughts that had dominated filmmaking in the post-war years. Mm-hmm. He is truly young. His politics are aligned with the progressives and the youth revolution. He's not interested in the fading aristocracy. He's not interested in looking back at what Europe was. Mm-hmm. He sees Europe. He sees Rome for what it is. And he sees incredible beauty in all of this architecture and art and culture that surrounds him and makes it the central focus of the film. The bird with the crystal plumage becomes a massive worldwide hit. Makes $1 million in Italy alone. Makes millions more around the world. Mm-hmm. And now the scramble is on. Everybody is now trying to make gialli. And they're all trying to make them in the style of Argento, who not only is throwing unbelievable murder scenes up on the screen, but is also moving the modern lighter weight cameras around in ways that no one's ever seen before. Mm-hmm. At the film's climax, he actually drops a camera off the side of a building.
Yeah.
And films it.
Yep.
And destroyed the camera in the process. But wasn't supposed to, but naturally, you're going to destroy the camera when you're doing that.
I don't think that was his first time either. He ended up destroying quite a few cameras after that.
Yeah, he destroyed quite a number of pieces of film equipment over the course of his career. Mm-hmm. And also immediately shot to the top of the Italian film scene.
Yeah.
He was branded the Italian Hitchcock, and he would proceed to churn out several more films over the next couple of years. And it's the modernness of it. In the same way that Hitchcock's Psycho basically said the evil lives just off the road.
Sure.
If you go down that road into the woods, if you get off the highway and you stop at that little place down the road,
yeah,
you're going to be in trouble. Argento is taking that a step further. And he's basically saying the evil is next door.
He also puts you right in the scene there.
And the other thing he does, and the other thing that he does that's very novel and very different, is almost all of The Bird with the Crystal Plumage takes place during the day, mm-hmm. or in brightly lit spaces.
Right.
So in that opening scene, yes, it's nighttime, but we're seeing everything through this white-walled art gallery with these floor-to-ceiling glass doors. Mm-hmm. Everything is beautifully well lit. It looks a little bit like Kubrick's Clockwork Orange years before Kubrick would make that movie.
Right.
So all of these shadows and light and dark that we had in the Hammer films and the Edgar Allan Poe adaptations and all of that stuff is thrown out the door.
Yeah.
This is as modern as it gets. And horror cinema is never going to go back from this moment again. Mm-hmm. Even when you get into gothic horror later on, they're adapting this Italian style, which is like, you can have shadows, but the shadows have to be lit.
Right.
You can have violence, but the violence has to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great if you have a horror scene that's right in the middle of the day or striking lights, you know. It's just like, it's amazing.
So 1970, there are 10 Giallo films, including Bird with the Crystal Plumage. After the success of Bird with the Crystal Plumage, 1971 brings 27 Gialli mm-hmm. out of Italy, including there are German and Italian co-productions and a couple of Spanish films as well. 1972, 28 more Gialli are made. And 1972 brings us possibly one of the most influential Gialli of all time. It is a film called A Bay of Blood, better known in the United States as Twitch of the Death Nerve. Mario Bava back once again. Mm-hmm. And this film kind of breaks the Gialli mold a little bit. He's still caught up in the sort of gothic sensibilities. This film takes place in an old decaying palazzo out in the middle of the woods, in the middle of nowhere, and concerns family members who are killing each other so that they can be the sole heirs of the family fortune. Mm-hmm. It does have the black-gloved killer. It doesn't have the police, but it does have some of the most shocking and over-the-top murder sequences that are going to be found in any giallo. Mm-hmm. When the film came to the United States, it caught the attention of a gentleman by the name of Steve Miner. Steve Miner had been a protege of Sean S. Cunningham, who was one of the top grindhouse producers and distributors in the United States of America. Had Last House on the Left to his credit, among other films. Mm-hmm. So Steve Miner sees this, and he sees his future in it. He takes the location, dumps the palazzo, keeps the killings, and makes a movie called Friday the 13th. A Bay of Blood is a direct predecessor of Friday the 13th. Mm-hmm. And Friday the 13th, for my money, has always been interesting because it is a giallo. If you slice that ending off of the film, that jump scare at the very, very end of the movie,
right?
Everything else in Friday the 13th fits the giallo. There is no hockey mask in the first Friday the 13th.
Right.
There is a black-gloved, unseen, unknown killer.
Right.
And a lot of kids dying under mysterious circumstances. Mm-hmm. He basically strips it down to the core element and says, you know what? People are coming to these movies to see the blood and guts. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to give them the blood and guts. We wrap a little bit of story around this, you know, just to make it convincing or to give it some artistic merit. But really, this is all about making the blood flow. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much what Bay of Blood is as well. As far as Bava's work goes, it is the least intellectual, the least rational, the least coherent of his films. But boy damn, does it serve up some good murder scenes. Mm-hmm. And from that point, we go almost directly to the American slasher. 1973 sees the genre in retreat. Only 12 films released in 1973. But one of them I know is a Chris Earle favorite. Sergio Martino produced this infamous little number which is considered among the best of all time, and certainly among the most graphic of all time.
What you've seen is only a sample, not a product of abstract art. What you have here are fragments of tissue found under the fingernails of one of your companions, barbarously murdered in the middle of the night 1 week ago. Our scientific analysis has traced them to this foulard, which was used to strangle Carol Peterson. Her body was then mutilated in the same brutal manner as her friend. If you have ever seen a scarf like this on any person you can identify, it is your duty to report it either to the police or the university authorities. I might add that no one in Perugia, either man or woman, is safe until this killer is captured and brought to justice. And I hope in a case like this, at least, you will consider the police for what they are, your vigilant defenders of life and liberty. After that, you can protest, if you like, against what you call social injustice.